kind of knew Gavin was always like had big ambitions, but then, you know, this computer at the center of the world, Gavin's kind of reinventing the idea of a computer. Filmmakers talk about being a fly on the wall and subject forgetting the camera exists. I don't believe that at all.
Visualization.
Yeah, I was
with cameras.
With cameras, yeah, yeah.
Is this part
someone
of it?
Forgot to tell me. Tell me.
The launch team wishes you good luck and Godspeed.
Space Monkeys, blasting off with Simon Hipkins, producer, director, filmmaker, storyteller at Key Pictures, the production company behind Behind the Code. We're very lucky to have him on the show with us. Simon, welcome to Space Monkeys.
Thanks for having me.
Behind the Code was the piece of content that got me focused on something that I ended up being extremely passionate about. I know many other people were grabbed by Behind the Code as well. How did you get involved in creating Behind the Code?
Well, first, thanks, Jay. It's really nice to hear that. It's always really nice to hear that from people. It goes back to, I think it was early or late 2016.
Yeah.
I just moved to Berlin and Gavin got in touch with me because I knew Gavin for a long time. Actually, we grew up together. We went to high school together.
I see.
In the north of England. But I hadn't actually seen him for maybe, at that point, maybe it had been eight, nine years. So I had, you know, I'd missed out on Gavin's story in Ethereum and everything that had happened to him. Anyway, he got in touch with me and I think we'd exchange messages now and again over the years,
sure.
But I hadn't seen him in person for, I think, at least 8 years. Anyway, he messaged me and said, oh, are you still making films? And I just got back from a whole bunch of filming in Southeast Asia. I think I was actually just in Albania when he messaged me making a film there. And I was like, oh, yeah, I am. I'm actually moving to Berlin. And he's like, oh, I'm in Berlin. Let's meet up. And then I think it went a couple of months by before we got to meet up. And then he met up and then he told me about what he'd been up to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've kind of been doing this thing called Ethereum.
Oh, wow.
And then he told me a bit about it and I kind of watched some videos about it.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any knowledge really at that point of blockchain or cryptocurrency or Bitcoin even.
Yeah.
But then I watched the thing about Ethereum and I thought, oh, wow, this is big. Like I knew Gavin was always like had big ambitions. But then I think the first film I watched or video I watched of him on YouTube was him talking about this kind of computer for everyone to use, you know, this computer at the center of the world.
Hmm.
And it was a very like captivating story.
Exactly.
Like really, I thought this is like Gavin's kind of reinventing the idea of a computer here in a way. That's how my first impression of it was.
Right.
Then he asked me to start filming with him, which, you know, I did because he said, oh, I'm working on this new thing, the new thing that became Polka Dots.
Okay.
And then I just filmed basically on and off over several years.
Hmm.
I mean, simultaneously to that, I was still making my own films, documentaries. I actually ended up, because of this kind of more global interest in blockchain technology, doing a television series for a channel in Singapore called Channel News Asia, which is like a 4 1-hour series telling the sort of story of Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, and the kind of next generation of blockchain technologies, called Inside the Crypto Kingdom. You can have a watch. It's a bit old now, but it's still a lot of good stuff in there.
Okay.
And I mean, fascinating characters, kind of with a lot of utopian ideas, you know, and real, like, I mean, I don't think I'd seen anyone short of like some real kind of people who are really into their kind of left wing or scarily right wing politics, people who are so single-minded, but in a kind of way that was about achieving consensus rather than division. And I was like, oh, this is fascinating. This is like, this could be actually a force for good in the world and society. Of course, like I also covered loads and loads of like get rich quick, pump and dump schemes.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah. A big part of it.
But then anyway, basically I did that series, but carried on filming with Gavin over the years. And at some point, I think as it was like getting ready to launch, or like a year or so before the launch, I was like, Gav, we need to do something with this material.
Mm.
I think we've got enough to start telling the story.
Okay, so you were just collecting without any real solid idea of what
it was. Yeah, right? It was really, I was like, what were you? I mean, it was kind of always fun because I, you know, obviously know Gav well, I'm friends with him. So it was fun to go and see all these kind of different things and different characters. But I was like, at some point, this has got to turn into like a story. We have to start putting it into a story.
Of course.
And then I was like, let's do, you know, sort of 3 or 4 episodes telling the story of Polkadot.
Yeah.
Why it was being developed, what problems it was trying to solve. And kind of, you know, kind of tell the story for people to get into. And that's what became Behind the Code.
Something that caught my ear there. You said Gavin had always had big ideas. What sort of stories about Gav from when you knew him before come to mind when you say that?
I think he was always trying to create, like, I mean, from when I knew him, which was from about age 11 onwards, he was, you know, very early into programming, coding, was making games, was kind of, I think I made some graphics for one of his computer games once. Other people were doing other things. Other people were making, I think someone made some music.
Okay, wow.
And then, so, you know, he was always into like trying to create worlds in a way, I think, you know, and create like his relationship with computers felt very like natural, you know? I mean, felt like he was kind of, knew what he was doing, you know, really.
It sounds like he had that human element too, the ability to organize people and lead people on a
definitely goal. I would say that. I think also it was kind of exciting and something new. People wanted to get involved with doing it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, you know, exciting to see these very simple games now, but like something that someone you know has kind of programmed and made and then you can play, you know. I think when I met him again in Berlin and he told me about, you know, Ethereum and then his plan for the next thing, his next project, I was like, wow, this is like, this is extraordinarily ambitious. I wasn't even thinking about whether it was going to be successful or not.
Hmm.
But I thought the endeavor of doing it would be incredibly interesting, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
To sort of see if this is possible to do. And then seeing over the years the actual, how it's developed and how many people are now involved, and now, you know, Polkadot being this, like, you know, I think it only really sunk into me, for me, like in the last 6 months or so, this idea of like Polkadot being the world's biggest DAO. And now it's like a sort of self-sustaining technology that's kind of evolved, that keeps evolving.
Gavin knew he was onto something big. This is why he asked you to come and film it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he pretty much said that to me. He was like, this is going to be big. We need to kind of document this and see this is kind of going through. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's... I have to be honest, I was like, I don't know how big it's going to be, but it's going to be interesting. Sure. So we should start filming.
Yeah, fly around a bit and film, see what happens. So when you think back to those years of filming Behind the Code, obviously Gavin is a central character there. What are some other characters that come to mind that caught your interest and maybe in a surprising way?
I guess Louis was a great character. Louis was a friend of Gavin's who I think he'd been involved with, helped Gavin get involved in the early days of Ethereum, or at least had been talking to him around that time.
Oh.
And Louis ended up doing the original kind of design and focus for the crowd loan and to try and capture people.
Oh.
And basically, yeah, Louis's like a Glaswegian guy, great character, but he was also very excited about the possibilities of the technology. And but sure. I'd also been through, I guess I'd already been through like, you know, different bull and bear markets with Bitcoin. So he was also kind of like had perspective on the whole industry.
Gotcha.
Obviously, Yuta was like a real driving force, I think, you know, as well. I mean, Genevieve, who was the original kind of Web3 Foundation director who'd helped raise a lot of the initial money, was a real dreamer and dreamer and utopian about the technology. And I think she's still very much like watching it and happy to see that it's like grown where it's grown. So there is a lot of passionate people, you know, as there still are today, but really a lot of people are working day and night. You know, I could see that to try and make it happen, you know.
Well, I'm excited to go back and watch it again. You know, it would be 4 years or 3 years since I saw it, and to get perspective on the past before we dive into, you know, what's coming next. How would you articulate the story that you told in the final product of Behind the Code? What was that story?
I mean, it was this, I guess, this idea, creating a tool, in a way, Polkadot, like creating a tool that enabled people to do things that hadn't been possible before,
okay,
but also in a way that kind of forced them to do it together. And it almost also, you know, it was also very much the story of like a vision of an idea of Gavin to try and do that. But then I think we tried to articulate, maybe not fully successfully, which is also maybe part of the reason why I want to do a second season to see how like that then gathered momentum with lots of other people and resonated with lots of other people around the world who also wanted to see that happen, because it was quite focused on Gavin's vision and wanting to set out and to try and build this. And it was only in the later episode we got into the story of like people creating the parachains and things. And I think now the landscape's a lot more interesting in terms of like, it feels like there's a whole community there. Totally. You know, whereas at that point I still think the community was emerging.
Kind of around this leader.
Yeah, exactly. And the governance system was quite centralized and around the council, and it was a bit mysterious and you know. But now I think since open governance, and then, you know, I think that's
blown the top off, really.
Yeah. I think that kind of enabled the community massively.
What's it all about making films for you? I guess you've been making them since high school, at least.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of, since very young, since like the age of like 10 or 11, you know, making different sorts of films. But yeah, mainly I was attracted to documentary making because the kind of story emerges out of the material that you're filming. So the real documentary filmmaking is you might have some ideas when you go in, but you kind of throw those out of the window quite quickly once you start filming, or hang on to some of them, but then carry on responding to the material, seeing what the story's kind of emerging, and then finding that story in the material. I find like a really fascinating process, because you're able to kind of play with time in a way that's quite specific, I guess, to the medium, to filmmaking. So you can put together clips from 12 months apart and reveal something in a way that, you know, you couldn't see with the naked eye.
So cool.
Finding that story is the exciting part of it.
I think people don't realize, manipulated is not the wrong word, but how much influence filmmakers have over the story that arrives in people's mind. You know, we receive it as some sort of record of truth, but the final product is really this creative endeavor.
Very much so. I mean, a documentary making isn't objective, you know?
Right.
It's not, I don't believe that for a minute. I mean,
you
attempt to find a truth, you know, to discover a truth and to portray a truth, I guess. But the truth is the truth is somewhat subjective, you know? Mm. And then you might be attracted to certain filmmakers because you like the truth they're telling you. You like, you kind of believe their truth, or you see the truth in that way. There are things you try and be objective about when you're filming. It's not like you're trying to be subjective all the time, but the very nature of picking up a camera and putting it in someone's face immediately makes it subjective, because, you know, you're filming certain things, positioning the camera in a certain way, but the person in front of you is also changed. So they also start performing. So, you know, I think in real, like, observational kind of filmmaking, where you're kind of following people for a long time, there's a point where sometimes documentary filmmakers talk about being a fly on the wall and the subject forgetting the camera exists. I don't believe that at all.
Mm.
I just think at some point the person being filmed starts to direct themselves, yeah. you know, and starts to kind of perform in a more natural or, you know, believable manner.
Totally,
because
yeah.
they've become more confident around the camera rather than becoming less self-confident about the camera, I think, yeah.
I've personally never done anything longer than like an interview like this. I've never done a documentary or anything like that. If you're filming over years, how do you structure that material? And then how do you, from that, find a story? What's your process?
The best way to do it is to start kind of editing the material, kind of working with the material with observational footage. You're looking at the material and then you're seeing the potential narratives that were captured in the material.
Hmm.
Sometimes, like, you know, there'll be, you might film like an interaction of people and there might be three or four potential narratives or moments of narrative in that scene.
Yeah.
Then you kind of have to identify like, okay, what's that scene about? So that scene's kind of playing this function. It's like, that's the potential storyline or plot point narrative in there. And you do this like multiple times with all your material or as much of it as you think is useful. You know, you might say, you know, some material's no good, you throw that away. But ideally you work through a lot of the material and then you have all these scenes
okay.
with all these different story points
hmm.
and different ideas. And then, you know, for that, I like to work quite physically with it. So I turn them all into like cards or bits of paper. And then you start playing around with the assembly of that and basically creating a paper. We call it like a paper edit.
Yeah. Okay.
And you've got all your scenes laid out and each scene's like playing a different point and how am I going to begin it? How am I going to end it? And then you put those together, watch it, what works, what doesn't work.
Yeah.
Then, you know, go to the drawing board, have another go at doing this. And then,
of course, yeah.
And then you'll start to find a lot of duplication. Some scenes will be doing the same thing.
Sure.
Or some scenes have just become redundant because it's conveyed in the subtext of the story. So you then can start to like work on different layers and levels and, you know, because it becomes fascinating really. And then do you want to bring in sound design and music narratively to tell part of the story as well?
Yeah.
And then at some point I think the material speaks to you and tells you what to do, you know.
Yeah,
that's really, I mean, it also helps to work, like, I mean, to do this on your own will drive you crazy. Like, it helps to work with a good it helps to work with a good editor.
Oh, okay.
Who becomes, I mean, a good documentary editor
is
like a second director on the,
of course,
on the,
it would be.
Yeah, so
you don't do a lot of your own editing?
I did. I used to. Yeah. I mean, I used to actually work as an, I worked as an editor for several years, just doing it for other people's stuff. But I sometimes edit my own material, but I'll try and work with an editor at some level, whether it's like,
they can take a huge load off.
Yeah. To take just the, like, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to do it. So even if it's like, I have a couple of good editors when they're available to work with, who will kind of like, we'll kind of edit together because they know I quite like to get hands on in the edit as well.
Yeah, right.
But it's absolutely essential to work with someone. I mean, I think ideally, like, the whole filmmaking process, depending on the ambition of the piece, is the more people you can get involved and collaborate with who you have a good working relationship with is great. You know, I have a composer I always work with, same composer who actually did the music for Behind the Code, and different camera people, different sound recordists. So,
brilliant.
Yeah.
Out of the whole process, what's the point that you enjoy the most?
Putting the music on.
Really? Because it's almost over?
No, because you try and work with the music fairly early on to get a feel for it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But I do this thing where I came up with this thing with the composer. We were like, let's do the four corners, right? What are the four corners of the story? You have no idea, but you might think, like, that scene is really important. It's going to be in the story somewhere.
Hmm.
That scene's important. I don't know which corner they are at this point, or where they are in the circle of the narrative, but these are points that are going to be important.
Yeah.
We put those together and then the composer looks at them and kind of responds to them musically, and then in terms of ideas and sound design. And it, when you start to kind of get that synergy happening and like kind of synthesis thing happens, and then it's like that's the magic. That's real magic. Occasionally when you're filming, especially when you've kind of really struggled to get something, because often when you film, you can't always easily see what the really good stuff is because you're so focused on the process.
And sometimes things come out way better than you thought they would.
Yeah, exactly. So, but sometimes you get like, wow, that was worth it.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I used to film with a larger camera, but like just filming by myself, I don't know, the battery would die, it would overheat. Like there was just all these little things that could go wrong. It just added up to a worse experience, you know? It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough to work very professionally, as you do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what it's like, Jay. It's like especially I think in what we're doing now, where there's a lot of travel, and sometimes I've been lucky in that I've had some great people to work with.
Yeah.
My colleague Matt has been amazing. And then there was another friend of mine, Julio, who helped out a lot with the first series. And I was very lucky to have their help. But yeah, sometimes you're doing it on your own. It's like,
what's the one part of the process that is a slog for you, but you know, you can't hand over to somebody else? Or
I think probably the stuff, especially because this is quite, you know, people's trying to lock people down and try and be in the right position at the right time. Sometimes that like,
okay,
logistics is like, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. That does suck.
It's the bit that's like, oh, but I need to be here and I also need to be here. And, you know, I'm always running late.
You need to make sure everything's charged.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe you've hit the nail on the head. It's like when you've gone through that all day and then you come back to your hotel room, probably after having a drink because you needed to calm down a bit after the day, and you've got to charge everything up and copy the cards over.
Oh, that, yes.
That's possibly the worst part of it. Yeah.
So our audience knows you and I both had a day like this today, actually. Yeah. Here we are half starving, ready to go to dinner. Yeah. But we have to film this because for some reason, and I think you've alluded to it already, you've decided we need a part 2 of Behind the Code.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did this come from?
I mean, one thing came from like the fact that I didn't think the first season we really got into like the sense of the bigger picture and the community that had grown about, because it was so, it was at the point the last episode dropped as the parachains were launched. So it was like the thing had only really just got going.
So cool.
Know? And then I guess just seeing, you know, like I had continued to film on and off again, different events and different conferences, Sub-Zero and Decoded, but I hadn't been filming in the same way as I had been for the first series. It was more like now and again dipping in, and then it just kind of really came to me, I guess, with the how OpenGov had like mobilized a lot of people.
Yeah,
I think it was a moment of the, I mean, in all honesty, it was at the parity retreat in Mallorca with the when they announced the big decentralization. Yeah, I was
with cameras.
With cameras, yeah, yeah.
Oh, is this part
someone
of it?
Forgot to tell me that someone forgot to tell me.
Oh my God, is this part of the story?
Maybe it could be. It's
delicately told, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It could be. But But basically, at that point, I mean, I think, obviously, it was. I think it was. You know, it was quite hard for a lot of people who'd worked for years at Parity. I mean, and then especially as I think that it took some time for people to realize that there were lots of opportunities to do other things beyond Parity, to work in this decentralized way. But yeah, the initial thing I think was quite, you know, quite traumatic for some of the people who worked there. So it was awkward to film it, to be honest. It was pretty awkward to film
filming a breakup.
Yeah. Well, like it felt like maybe a slow motion car crash. Maybe. Hopefully it didn't, you know. But I think, you know.
So that's where it came from. That's where you thought, shit.
Well, I was like, you know, this is it now. This is the moment when really, you know, it's kind of up to the community now to make this happen and to make this work. there's a story to be told. Like, you know, the storyteller alarm went off on me, and it's like, this has got to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah. You know?
Because it felt like pretty dramatic, to be honest, the situation, because I'd seen Parity obviously quite become, you know, employ more and more people over the years.
Yeah.
And then to just say, right, we're going to give it all, not give it all up, but give up a lot of what they were doing to the community to kind of take over with. I thought great, to be honest.
Too.
I mean, I thought like, I was very, very sorry for people who were there, who lost their jobs completely. Like, I don't think we can disregard that. I hope a lot of them have found opportunities elsewhere or
lots
continuing.
Of talented people.
Yeah. But for the technology as a whole, and for like the ambition of the technology, it's like I think it's enabled a lot of people, let's say that, who would probably have had a lot of passion and have been waiting to do things that they wanted to do and wanting to see happen. Now they can just get on and do it, you know?
It did in a way feel like this weight was lifted off the ecosystem. Parity was in the mouths of people a lot leading up to that point, but then when this decision was made, there was this vacuum that suddenly people rushed to fill. Some were from Parity and some were not. But
exactly. I mean, now it definitely made me excited to like start following the story again properly and capturing it, because I was like, and then to be honest, I was like at that point and since then engaging again and just seeing how many, you know, I'd been kind of keeping fairly up to speed with what had been happening, but not in a deep way.
Yeah.
And now, after a few months of kind of meeting lots of people, talking with people, I really see like it's really progressed massively. Excited to sort of capture it and see what story emerges, really. Yeah.
So what have you got so far? Where have you filmed?
So far, I mean, we've kind of got the Treasury proposal was approved in early Feb. Within a couple of weeks, we were filming in New York. So we filmed with Frank McCourt, was our first interview, which I think was a great first person to speak to.
Yeah, super.
Because he's got such a big vision for like kind of Web3 and like the kind of things that basically the tools that Polkadot can enable to help create this idea and why we need it. And he makes a very good argument for why we need it, you know? And then on to kind of ETH Denver to sort of document what was happening there at the Hacker House. And the very, very kindly Web Zero let us use the Hacker House to then shoot lots of interviews with different people.
Nice.
So basically just talk. I mean, the first thing is like talking with a lot of people, capturing some footage of people in action. I hope some of the people I've been filming with, I think, will film over the course of the year. And then put the stories together towards the later episodes, so we see a bit more of a development, especially with some of the people who are just kind of trying to get those Treasury proposals in and go through things. I mean, somewhat filming speculatively to see where stories go as well.
Yeah, sure, right.
And follow those up over the course of the year, hopefully. I mean, I can see some of them. I think we did some filming in New York. We did with Spencer, who then did the Parity Denver. Like, I can see how, like, you know, but then I keep meeting. That's so many. There's so many people, right? It's going to be really hard. Like, and I'm sure there's going to be plenty of stories that are missed, you know, which I'll be sorry for. But I think we're just trying to like get a good balance of different stories from different people in different stages, people just coming in, people who've been in for a long time and are kind of developing things more, people who've come in maybe a couple of years ago and had like enormous success within a couple of years, which I really see, you know, happening.
Well, there's always part three for anybody you missed.
Yeah.
You know, we can come back around.
Yeah.
I don't know what that story would be like. Maybe, you know, the first nation onboarding onto Polkadot or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Something like that. Somebody was talking about that the other day, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the first episode, this whole idea of like a network state and like exploring that idea is, I think, you know.
Have you got Ed on?
Not yet. I was due to do him here, but we couldn't.
Is he gone already?
He's in Lisbon anyway, so I'm going to try and catch him. I'm going to try and catch him in Lisbon.
He's on my list too, man. I can't wait to talk to him.
Yeah. I think he's... actually, I met him for the first time at the Polkadot, very early Polkadot first meetup in Ibiza. It's where I met him before there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was super excited about it.
Yeah, what a force, eh?
I guess what we're going to see now with the Energy Web happening.
Yeah.
Polkadot.
So what's this going to look like on the rollout?
The episodes are going to be quite... The idea is for the episodes to be quite accessible. So we're not going to be going like super deep into the tech. Hopefully we'll get them working on different levels. So there's like people are still interested in. But the episodes should be about inspiring people to kind of get involved and come into this world. We would just want in like the inspirational story, and also, you know, the challenges of like trying to create this, you know,
sure,
as a kind of a thing that we realized, like, I mean, it was in the back of our mind, I think, when we did the proposal, was to do this repository that people could use more of the interviews and more of the material. And then I think start editing the interviews, and I was like, oh God, these interviews are really good. It's a real shame to like throw 90% of it away, or maybe 95% of it away, and just use 5%.
Because part of your gathering material, you're interviewing people for 15, 20, 30 minutes.
Oh, longer. I mean, like sometimes an hour and a half,
sure,
you know?
Yeah.
But there's always like, in the really good ones, there's like, you know, some really interesting conversations and deep, I guess, like almost less conversations, because the style of interviewing them is more like exploratory and getting to go over certain thematics. But that stuff could be really, I was like, this stuff could be really useful for use to kind of educate and show people, and people who are just very into Polkadot and wanting to go deeper, because a lot of people get into this and then they want to explore more and
exactly and
learn more, and it's changing all the time, and in different insights give people ideas. Basically, that's, you know, when you listen to all of these things, people are like, oh, what about this? If this can work with this, maybe that can happen.
Totally.
So we're going to release, you know, thanks to you on the Kusamarium, we're going to release the kind of interviews in more long form as like a Web3 thinkers, Web3 builders series.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do a Web3 creators as time goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
And each one of those will be like a deep dive into like that person's sort of story and their projects and what they're kind of thinking.
It's very exciting for all of Polkadot to be able to see these full episodes. So playing with time a little bit, we can say we're very happy to be partnering with Key Pictures, and our audience got the first taste of it when we released that Gavin, 2 hours of Gavin on Jam last week. That's just incredible that you got that footage, and, you know, on the weekend where he released the paper to the world. And what's going to happen is every week, except for weeks where you release a full episode, we're going to release a broadcast from the Coos, another one of these interviews that you gathered along the way.
Excellent. Yeah. What I really hope is that people can take that material, you know, and start to use that material on their own platforms, their own distribution channels, ideally, you know, multilingual, so that people can take it and reversion it into different languages and kind of, you know, get it to the different communities of different parts of the world. Because I think that's something I personally really like to see in places where there's a huge adoption of crypto and Polkadot isn't as well known as it should be.
Yeah, totally.
To see those things kind of happening, you know.
Yeah. So we're going to have all the material organized so people can pick it up and do whatever they want with it, really, right?
Yeah, that's it. It's available. Yeah. It's available and freely available in the Creative Commons. So it's kind of, get it. Please, people will get out there and do something with it.
Exactly,
yeah.
It's actually a great way to get involved. If you're looking for some way to help out with Polkadot, you can pick up any of the Coos material, any of your material now once it's released, and you could just start cutting it, start broadcasting it, just put it in front of new people who wouldn't see it otherwise. This is a massive help. This is basically creating a conversation.
Exactly, yeah, really. And a library of material and a library of kind of things to kind of explain the narrative, you know?
And
everybody's audience, I think, is different. People know their audience is much better than we do, maybe. That's right. And it's like, so they can take it and put it into their own, put it into their own audience. And, you know, if they need to have interviews then with other people locally, they can add that material into it and kind of contextualize it for their own audience.
That's right. So when is the release of the first episode?
So the first episode, it's a good question. The first episode is going to be released on May the 16th.
Yeah.
May the 16th. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to have a little screening in Lugano on the 15th in the evening, and then we're going to release it online on the 16th. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And you're broadcasting it through the official Polkadot channels?
That will be released on the official Polkadot channels. Yeah, exactly. On the official YouTube Polkadot.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm so looking forward to seeing it. You're an absolute wizard in what you do. And like I said, you brought me and so many people to the ecosystem, which isn't us just walking up. All these people are contributing now and, you know, helping the story grow.
Exactly. I mean, it's like, it's amazing to hear that when people tell me that they watched the first series and when it really got them in. It makes me feel like, God, that was... That was worth all that effort. Yeah.
All right, Simon. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Great. Thanks, Jake. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.